Hello, Sun Sounds listeners. This is Michael Shannon, a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading for Arizona History. The Bascom Affair appeared in Volume 10 of the Wild West Collection published by the Arizona High-Res Magazine in 2001. This is a story about how the Cochise Apache War of 1861 began. It is a story of treachery and betrayal, incompetence and double-cross. And now for the Bascom Affair. Cochise's war erupted with exquisite fury in 1861, 24 years after the Johnson Massacre. The episode that sparked it, known as the Bascom Affair, has been analyzed, reconstructed, and tipped upside down more than any other in relations between the whites and the Apaches. Yet the events remain cloudy. Eyewitnesses and those who came on the scene within days differ in their accounts, although the reader can sense in their words an awareness that what they saw and described was momentous. This was a drama that could not have been invented. Its two central players shared little in common except for an outsized pride, a belief in their own importance, and those feelings could only drive events to a no good end. Kentucky-born George N. Bascom graduated from the United States Military Academy at West Point in 1858, finishing an unspectacular 26th in a class of 27. He had been an Army lieutenant in Arizona for 5 months when he was ordered to Apache Pass to retrieve a kidnapped boy. Not yet 25 years old, Bascom was supremely stubborn and can be perceived and, we could presume, derived much of what he believed about Apaches from his imagination. The Chiricahua leader Cochise was a revered figure among his people, their absolute leader, approximately 50 years old at the time, intelligent, tall, with well-chiseled features. He had 3 brass rings in each ear and projected a dignity that could cow a toughest man. But when crossed, as he was by Bascom, he became what Indian haters believe he was, savage. These two adversaries came together on February 4, 1861. The month before, Apaches had raided a ranch in the Sonoyta Valley of what is now southeastern Arizona, driving off some cattle and stealing a 12-year-old stepson of ranch owner John Ward. Based on tracks, both Ward and Arizona's military leaders assumed the raiders were bound for Apache Pass, a crucial divide on the route to California between Dos Cabezas and Chiricahua Mountains. The pass was home to Cochise and his band, so they were presumed guilty. Bascom and 54 men of the 7th Infantry rode out of Fort Buchanan, south of Tucson, near Patagonia, with orders to do what was proper to recover the stock and the boy, Felix Ward, and in the bargain to pursue and chastise such marauding parties. The soldier arrived at the Overland Stage Station in Apache Pass on Sunday, February 3rd. After sending word to Cochise requesting a meeting, Bascom headed into Siphon Canyon, 3/4 of a mile away, to make camp. Late the following day, Cochise arrived with his wife, his younger brother, Coyuntura, 2 of his children, and 2 or 3 warriors, possibly his nephews. Historians believe his decision to bring family members indicates that he anticipated no trouble, having had nothing to do with the Ward raid. Exactly what transpired inside Bascom's tent that day remains somewhat mysterious. The likeliest version, based on several accounts, is that Bascom served dinner to Cochise, his brother, and one of his nephews. Then, after friendly talk, the lieutenant turned accuser, naming Cochise as the perpetrator of the raid. The chief denied it, He said the boy had been taken by members of the Coyoteros band, who held him captive in the Black Mountains. Cochise then offered to try to bring Felix Ward in if Bascom were willing to remain at the stage station for 10 days. But that wouldn't do for the lieutenant, who firmly believed Cochise was responsible and had plotted all along to take the chief prisoner. As soon as Cochise had entered the tent, Bascom's soldiers surrounded it to prevent escape. After Cochise's offer, the lieutenant announced that the chief and his people would be held hostage until the boy was returned. Enraged, Cochise drew his knife, slashed open the back of the tent, and fled, with his brother and one warrior following. In the account of an eyewitness, a soldier known only as Oberly, Bascom yelled, "Shoot them down." What happened to the first two escapees is unclear. Oberly said Coyuntura was stopped by a bullet through the leg. Another memoirist reported that one of them was knocked to the ground with the butt of a carbine, and the second bayoneted but survived. This much is certain. Neither one escaped. The third, Cochise, fled through a phalanx of army riflemen. An estimated 50 shots were fired as he raced over a hilltop, his coffee cup still in hand. Shortly thereafter, he reappeared and shouted down to Bascom, asking to see his brother, Coyuntura. Bascom answered with gunfire. After that, the chief raised his hand, swore revenge, and shouted, "Indian blood is as good as white man's blood." Then he left. The conflicting versions of this incident, as with several that followed, usually break down according to whether the teller supports the officer's actions or finds them reprehensible. Even today, Bascom personifies whatever viewpoint a chronicler wishes to expound. Oberly's recollections provide a case in point. Writing 25 years after the fact, he depicted Cochise as entirely friendly with Americans prior to this encounter, but that portrayal wasn't quite true. Furthermore, he was highly critical of Bascom, saying that the lieutenant was totally unfit to deal with the Apaches. He alone, among memoirists, implied that Bascom was a drunk, well supplied with commissary whiskey, which he used liberally. Oberly concluded, correctly on this point, that Cochise and his party had done absolutely nothing wrong and came into camp on a friendly invitation from Bascom and without fear of molestation. On the other hand, writing in 1887, B.J.D. Irwin, assistant military surgeon who arrived at Apache Pass 6 days after the tent episode, described Bascom and other Americans as victims of the cowardly and wicked Chiricahua chief. He said the lieutenant announced that he was keeping Cochise and his people only as a last resort after every effort at peaceful persuasion had proved futile. Adding to the murkiness surrounding the incident, Edwin Sweeney, Cochise's biographer, claimed that Bascom lied in his official report to his superior by saying he had consented to Cochise's proposition. If he had, an escape obviously wouldn't have been necessary. Sweeney said that all six of the written recollections of the incident by Americans concur that Cochise was not released but escaped. Looking back, Bascom had good reason to lie. He was embarrassed at losing the man he believed responsible for the Ward raid, thus touching off several days of spectacular violence. Bascom moved his command back to the Overland Stage Station, perhaps thinking that its rock walls would help protect his soldiers in the fight he believed was coming. On the morning after he had fled from the tent, Cochise appeared on the hill south of the station, accompanied by Cotera chief named Francisco and about 500 warriors. They presented a white flag of truce and asked to talk with Lieutenant Bascom. Four men from each party moved cautiously together, converging about 150 yards from the station. The meeting went nowhere. Cochise pleaded for the release of his family, and Bascom again insisted that Cochise return the Ward boy first. Then the unexpected happened. Three civilian Overland employees, James Wallace, Charles Culver, and the third man, identified only as Walsh or Welch, believing in their existing friendship with Cochise might break the stalemate, moved forward among the Indians, ignoring Bascom's order to stay back. When warriors concealed in the ravine rushed forward to capture the three, shooting broke out. Culver knocked down two of his Indian captives and broke for the stage station, along with Welch. Culver reached the front door before taking a bullet in the back and collapsing, severely injured. At the station's stone corral, which Welch propped his head above the rocks, whereupon a soldier on the other side, mistaken him for an Apache, shot him through the head, killing him instantly. Wallace remained a captive. One of the unarmed soldiers who accompanied Bascom were also unarmed. To the parley was wounded in the turmoil, and according to Irwin, one bullet passed through Bascom's clothing and another through his hat. Several Apaches probably were wounded as well, and a few were killed. That night, in the words of Sergeant Daniel Robinson, who told his version in the August 1896 issue of Sports Afield, the weird war cries of the squaws were distinctly heard wailing over their dead. At noon the following day, Cochise tried again to make an exchange. This time he appeared on a hill above the station, dragging a hungry and freezing Wallace behind him, the captive's hands tied behind his back and a rope looped around his neck. The chief asked for his family back in exchange for Wallace and 16 government mules. But Bascom's answer hadn't changed. He wanted the ward boy returned. Here dissension might have split Bascom's command, according to a controversial story told by Reuben Bernard, a sergeant in the 1st Dragoons. He claimed he was at Bascom's side that day and mounted a bitter protest against the lieutenant's decision to reject Cochise's deal. In his telling, published in a 1936 book titled The 103 Fights and Skirmishes, the story of General Reuben F. Bernard. Bernard said he protested in an effort to rescue Wallace. "Damn it, Lieutenant, here's a man whose life is at stake." After more arguing, Bascom supposedly responded, "Sergeant, you are insubordinate. Consider yourself under arrest." Bernard maintained that the insubordination charges against him were not pushed vigorously, and he was acquitted, but no record of any court-martial has been found, and significantly, records indicate that the 1st Dragoons did not arrive at Apache Pass until 8 days after the encounter described by Bernard. Bernard also stated that Cochise held two other white men as well, and that Bascom was unwilling to make the trade, unless it was for all three. But his chronology is wrong. Cochise didn't take additional prisoners until that night, when his men waylaid a 12-man wagon train hauling flour through the pass to New Mexico. The Chiricahuas considered nine of them worthy of execution on their nationality alone. They were Mexicans. The Indians tied the men by their wrists to the wagon wheels, tortured them, and then set fire to the wagons. Cochise kept the three Americans, not two, as Bernard said, as trade bait. They were Sam Whitfield, William Sanders, said to be half-breed Cherokee, and Frank Brunner, a German teamster. Also that same night, February 6, Cochise returned to the hill, overlooking the stage station, and left a note for Bascom. It was written by Wallace in charcoal, according to William Sanders, an Overland employee, and attached to a stake driven into the ground. "Treat my people well, and I will do the same by yours, of whom I have three." In truth, by then, it was four: Wallace, Whitfield, Sanders, and Brunner. Several chroniclers have made the same mistake as Bernard in handing Cochise more prisoners than he actually had at noon on February 6. But as wrong as Bernard was on that point, his claim of having been present cannot be ruled out. He might have been sent there as a part of a detachment prior to the arrival, after the 10th incident of the main body of Dragoons, and, as historian Dan Thrapp observed, an insubordination charge against Barnard might have been handled by a summary court-martial, a type that would not have been a matter for written record. Why Bascom didn't get Wallace's note remains a mystery, but for Cochise, the silence from the lieutenant was an answer to his offer, an unspoken death sentence for the four hostages. By early morning of February 7th, the Apaches attempted to waylay another eastbound stage in the pass, apparently to secure more hostages. Although the overland driver had his leg broken by a rifle bullet, the effort failed, and the coach reached the station about 2 a.m. During this time, according to Oberle, Bascom became thoroughly unnerved, cowering between the stone walls, afraid even to permit his parched soldiers to go for water at the spring nearby. Finally, after Sergeant Robinson safely filled six canteens, Oberle said, Bascom's craven fears were stilled, and he ordered the mules taken to the water, but they were attacked as they returned by a party of naked Indians painted and singing a war song. Like a flash, the entire place filled with Indians, said Oberle, on the February 8th fight. They seemed to spring from the earth. They were coming so openly and boldly that no doubt expected to sweep all before them without much trouble, according to Robinson. The sergeant was wounded in the shooting, a station employee killed, and the raiders made off with 56 mules, but the attack at the spring served only as a diversion. The main raid, meant to overrun the station and free Cochise's relatives, was underway, probably led by Cochise himself. A young Geronimo, then 38, and Chief Mangus Coloradas and his band were also present. But this force was driven off, too, by heavy fire from within the stone walls. With his failure to capture the station, Cochise gave up hope of retrieving his relatives and headed into Mexico. Bascom and his men, unaware of this, stayed put for 6 days, keenly awaiting the next Chiricahua raid. In the meantime, in response to a dispatch sent by Bascom on February 7th, two relief columns were en route to Apache Pass. One was a volunteer group of 14 men led by Assistant Sergeant B.J. D. Irwin out of Fort Buchanan. En route, as his party crossed a dry lake south of the present town of Wilcox, they encountered a Coyotero chief and two warriors herding 30 stolen ponies and 40 head of cattle. Irwin wrote that after a long and exciting chase and a running fight extending over several miles, he captured the Indians and the stock. He drove the animals ahead of his command to Apache Pass, where their arrival on February 10th was hailed with shouts of joy, as it was feared that the expected relief party had been intercepted and wiped out. Two companies of dragoons, led by Lieutenant Moore, arrived 4 days later from Fort Breckinridge, later named Camp Grant. With these reinforcements, scouting parties rode into the mountains, but they encountered no Apaches. On February 18th, however, the scouting soldiers spotted buzzards hovering in the sky, and riding to the scene, a small valley on the west side of the Chiricahuas, they found the horribly mutilated bodies of Cochise's four prisoners, Wallace, Whitfield, Sanders, and Bruner. Writing in 1877, primarily in defense of Bascom, Aury, who was present, said that only by the gold fillings of some of his teeth was he able to identify Wallace. All the bodies were literally riddled with lance holes, he said. The remains were taken to a mound studded with oak trees and buried. On the trip back to the station, Aury said, the shaken command decided to hang all the Indians held by Bascom to the trees that shaded our new-made grave. After unsaddling his horse, Moore relayed his decision to Bascom, who objected, believing he would face the censure of his superiors. But Aury said that Moore, as ranking officer, told Bascom he would assume all responsibility. In his typescript, however, Irwin said the decision to hang the Indians was made at his initiative. It was I who suggested, he wrote with evident pride, their summary execution, man for man. When Bascom objected, Irwin claimed the right to execute the three prisoners he had taken, regardless of what Bascom did. At that, the lieutenant relented. The three Cayuteros most likely had nothing to do with the Cochise-Bascom standoffs. Irwin would later receive the Medal of Honor for their capture. The next day, Moore, Irwin, and Bascom departed Apache Pass. When they reached the fresh graves of the four Americans, the soldiers stopped. Bascom led the six Indians to the oak trees and told them what was about to happen. The condemned men, according to Oberle, wanted to be shot instead of hanged, and they asked for whiskey. Both requests were denied. The Mesilla Times, a New Mexico newspaper, reported that one of the Indians, probably Coyuntura, went to the gallows dancing and singing, saying that he was satisfied that he had killed two Mexicans in that month. Another, the paper said, was begging piteously for his life before, as Robinson said, he and his fellows were hoisted so high by the infantry that even the wolves could not touch them. Cochise's wife and the two sons, including Naiche, who would become a chief himself and bedevil the army in the war's last days, was subsequently turned loose. But even this seemingly simple fact was layered in legend, this one created by Cochise himself. In October 1870, William F. Arney, an Indian agent in New Mexico, summoned the Southern Apache bands for a peace council, drawing some 790 members and their chiefs. Among them was Cochise, with whom Arney talked for several hours. In his version of the Apache Pass trouble described by Arney in the Santa Fe Weekly New Mexican for November 1, 1870, the chief said that two officers played a game of cards to determine whether the children should be hung, and that the one who opposed hanging won the game. Cochise also told Arney that the events of those 2 weeks so outraged him that he went on the warpath and had been fighting ever since. His explanation had been accepted by historians as the effective start of the Apache Wars with Americans, although the chief had committed raids and robberies as early as 1859. But the intensity of Cochise's warfare grew exponentially after Apache's Pass. That summer he killed as many Americans as he could find, all of them innocent, many hung upside down by the heels over a slow fire. His rage turned the southern portions of Arizona and New Mexico into a no man's land of bleached bones and charred wagon remains. It even included plans, ultimately unfulfilled, to wipe out Tucson and the mine settlement of Patagonia, then the only two populated towns in Arizona. Later in 1861, at the start of the Civil War, when military authorities abandoned Fort Breckinridge and Fort Buchanan, and unprotected civilians began leaving the territory, Cochise believed his effort at exterminations of Americans was the reason. As for Cochise at Apache Pass, it's tempting to wonder whether the matter might have been brought to a different conclusion, if not for his burning anger. Even though he did not initiate the encounter, he was tricked by Bascom. He did kill his hostages first, and left their remains where Americans were certain to find them. This, as he must have known, was his family's death sentence. Furthermore, killing the hostages ended any chance that the abducted boy, Felix Ward, might be returned to his family. Not long after Cochise's war ended, Felix Ward emerged in 1872 as Mickey Free and became one of the more fierce and renowned Army scouts in the Apache Wars. He had been raised by San Carlos Apaches as one of their own. Bascom's behavior was so unimpressive and made more so by the deceit in his official report. Author Sweeney noted that the lieutenant never mentioned that Welch was killed by his own men, instead leaving the impression Apaches had done it. Bascom also led his superiors to believe he'd received Wallace's note on the 6th when he didn't read it until the 8th, and he skipped over the loss of government mules as if it were a meaningless event for which he had no responsibility. Even so, Bascom was commended by his superiors and awarded two promotions before his death in action against Confederate troops in Valverde, New Mexico, a year later. What is most noteworthy about the Apache Pass disaster, however, was how much it foretold what was to come. Distinguishing features of the episode would show up again and again in American-Apache relations. Duplicitousness, savagery, and inability of Americans to distinguish between various bands of Indians, and similarly a willingness among the Indians to take revenge against any available Americans, regardless of culpability. The final feature, it seems, was its inevitability. Bascom, the West Pointer, was dutifully performing his country's work according to orders. And Cochise, the chief, was defending his family and his people, with each side behaving in a manner entirely sensible to them. The killing began in earnest. That brings us to the end of our story, The Bascom Affair. I hope you found our stories interesting. This is Michael Shannon, your Sun Sounds reader, and we'll have more stories for you the next time we meet. You missed a program, you can get it on demand at the Sun Sounds website, www.sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Scroll down to the programming links and choose On Demand Broadcasts. Sun Sounds is also available on your smart home device.